So this is on. So I just have to say at the very top that I'm Marsha Armani. I'm with Sue Waters at the Grange Whitson. And it is Monday, the 1st of July, 2019. Thank you, Sue, very much today. I wonder if we could just start that there. Could you just introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Sue Waters. I've lived at the Grange for the last 55 years, but I was born in Nash in 1945.
So what was your childhood like in Nash, Sue? What was Nash like as a child?
Well, Nash was a very quiet, sleepy little hollow of a village. Because it was a no-through area, very little happened there. And looking at today's village, there is absolutely no comparison. There were literally only half a dozen houses. And around the church, we had Church Farm, St. Mary's Lodge, and our cottage, Red House Farm. Then the other houses were outlying farms, perhaps half a mile from us, or a mile at the maximum. There was a little cluster of houses at Nash Arch, and Nash spread out quite a way, so you had other farmsteads further up the village and down the village. One or two along the seawall bank farm field where some relatives lived, and Saltmarsh Farm where Monica Howells lives. They've lived there all my lifetime, and a little tiny house near there. And that was our village. Life revolved around the church. The Waterloo Inn was there, but originally that was two cottages given by the Arney family who lived in Nash and were the patrons of the church. And they gave two cottages and 6 acres for the for the income to be spent on the poor of the village or the parish in those days. And it was only in latter years, I think it might have been late 1800s, that the two cottages were converted into a public house. So basically the school was opened in, I believe it was 1880, and all the village children went to the school.
Including yourself?
Oh yes, all my siblings. And it wasn't until after the war, about 1946, they built two, they had camps in the village that were built for the army, the air force, and we had encampments there of soldiers and whatever. After the war, there was a shortage of housing and people were put into these camps from London and various cities where the housing had been blitzed. So then, of course, we had an increase of children coming into our schools.
Are you far too... I mean, would you remember that? Remember the people coming down from the city?
Well, I remember them being in school with me, but that would have been 1950.
So where were these camps, Sue?
Well, one was at Pike Corner, opposite Tom German's. And I was led to believe by a cousin who was much, much younger than me, of David's, who remembers Diana Churchill being there. That was some claim to fame, but it was all top secret at the time. I think she was in the WAFs, was it, or something like that. And the other one was just where the Wetlands Centre is. That would be on top of the area where it would have been. So that brought a lot of children extra into the school.
Did they seem different to you? I mean, what was your experience of these young children?
Yes, well, it was difficult. I should imagine they found it difficult to fit in, because by the age of five, we knew children from the village and we'd become friendly, and we more or less stuck with our own friends then. So I don't remember too much. I do remember one little boy, his mum buying him marbles, and people in the village, we couldn't afford marbles. And I remember that. But no, we had an awful problem with head lice after that. As a child, that's the one thing you remember, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, the itch.
Yeah.
Mm. So. Did you ever go to the camps themselves?
I did go to the one at Pye Corner, but I don't... must have been when I was grown up. Not as children, because we didn't get to know the families. And, you know, life didn't take you too far away from home as a small child.
So what was Nash School like?
Oh, that was a lovely place. I've got such fond memories of it. We had three teachers. Miss Keat, who was a sister to the Keats that lived down at Porton. She was head teacher. There was two Mrs. Davises, so we managed to call the one Miss Millard. And she taught, Miss Millard taught the infants, and then Mrs. Davis taught the next age group. So the infants would have gone from 5 to 8. Then we would have gone from 8 to 10 in Mrs. Davis's class, and from 10 or till 11 when we moved on in Miss Keats' class. But so the large classroom was divided by a big red curtain, and then there was a stove in the centre. And as a child, I always remember Miss Keat leaning against the guard with pulling a skirt up at the back to warm herself. But there was a fire grate in Miss Millard's room, and always a fire in the grate through the winter months. And a lady by the name of Mrs. Walter, who lived on Nash Arch, she used to keep the fires burning. And Mrs. England as well. They were lovely, two lovely ladies, and pillar of the community, and we always remember by the time we got to school, it was wonderful. It was all warm.
Do you remember any playground games or anything like that?
Oh, it was mostly tag. Hopscotch was a big one. And we used to have skipping ropes, so we'd all be skipping, or, you know, where you have the large rope. Yes, we were very imaginative because we played games all the time. And all the children got on well. I don't remember bullying. I don't remember people being unkind. There were nicknames, but, you know, people didn't take much notice.
Were most of the children from farming stock?
I would suggest so. There were two playgrounds, one for the older children and one for the younger ones. Yes, they'd come from outlying farms. And if you go back generations before me even, when Hubert Jones was writing about his childhood in Nash, they would walk miles across the fields. And he talks of David's family all lived at Tatton Farm, which is down the bottom end of the village. And you would have had to come across at least 3 to 4 fields, and then a mile further down to school. And the Tatton family, as we called them, used to do that every morning. And everybody up Broad Street Common would have to walk down to school. So, yes, there was would have been mostly families involved in agriculture, whether they were farmers or farm labourers. It didn't make any difference. They all came.
And presumably children walked on their own without parents?
I think from that particular area, I think the children used to walk and meet each other and come up, depending on their age. I had a brother a year and a half older than me, and there was no pavement on the road where between our house and the school. So I remember waiting for my friend Elizabeth to walk up from Great House, and the three of us would walk up holding hands together. And then, you know, invariably somebody would catch you up from further down the road or whatever.
Did
Did you learn Welsh at school?
Oh, gosh, no, no. It was never a Welsh-speaking area. We were always classified as Wales and Monmouthshire. And Monmouthshire didn't particularly speak Welsh. So, no, no. My mother was from the Welsh Valleys, and I did remember learning a few words from listening to her, and she would sing in Welsh to me. always sang me lullabies, and she taught me so much about music. She played the piano, and I guess, whenever she sang, it was often in Welsh.
How lovely. So your parents were farmers?
Yes.
So what were their names?
Well, my father was John Collingbourne, and my mother was a Davis, and she was brought up in Fleur-de-Lis.
In Fleur-de-Lis?
Mm.
So what brought her to Nash?
Well, it must have been 1939 when her mother died, and she then decided she would probably get a job. So she went up to Crickhowell, and she was secretary to Colonel Rees in the War Office there.
Goodness.
And she lodged in a house in Crickhowell. And at that time, although my father was from a farming family, and they had butcher's shop and various outlets like that, he would suffered from pneumonia once or twice, and they said, I think you need to go up to the get different air, go up the hills, because his family had farmed on the Tredegar estate at Tredegar Park.
Yes.
So he went up there, and he ran, he had lorries, so he would move cattle and hay and straw and so forth, and he lodged at the same place as my mother. So they met,
yeah.
Decided to get married in, I think, 1942. And there's a lovely picture of them on the sideboard there. Do have a look.
Is this their wedding photo?
Yes.
Oh, gosh. Oh, what a gorgeous looking couple. God, your father's extremely handsome.
He was.
Yeah.
They were both black-haired.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
I used to be just the same.
Well, so did I too.
Anyway, I think the little farm in Nash, my uncles decided to take it on, and they asked my father if he'd like it. So then they moved straight down here. And although we had a farm, he became an agricultural merchant, and he owned an oil company as well. And we used to run it from the house.
Gosh.
So
Going back a bit, so he was had a farm on the Tredegar estate.
Mm-hmm.
So what, actually in the...
Sorry, you're going to have background noise. You'd think we were in a public car park.
So that was a family farm on the Tredegar estate, was it?
Yes, my father was one of 11 children, and they lived at Clepper Park at Kevin Logal Farm, which is right on the top of the hill opposite Tredegar House, very near what we call Gwerne Clepper, which was the old Iron Age settlements and so forth. And yes, you'll see photographs on the kitchen wall when one morning he took out 10 teams of plough horses, and they had the photographer in, and this was a 100-acre field, and they took these 10 teams out into this field to plough.
100-acre field?
Yes, it's where Clepper Park research station was based after they gave the farm up. Because I'm talking of the 1920s and 30s. Mm. But it's lovely. All of us family now have these pictures, which you can see in the kitchen, on the walls of a little bit of history.
So your parents moved to Nash,
yes,
to the farm, and but your mother, was she from a farming background?
Yes, their family had farms up in Fleur de Lis. They also had butcher shops and pubs and various other things. So they were all in business.
So yeah. What was it like? Was it different for your parents, I wonder, farming down here on the levels? Were there any particular challenges for them?
Well, father adapted to all of that. We only had a very small farm of, I think it was, perhaps 30 or 40 acres. And he did milk. We milked cows when he was young. But then the agricultural business took all over and it expanded. And then the oil came into it. And, of course, David and I took over some of the farming there after we got married. Eventually it was all given up anyway, the land. The council, Newport City Council, owned the land. We built a new house in the garden and moved from the cottage into the house. Not that it looks like anything like it was when I was a child.
What does it look like? Because we've had the power station, the wetland centres being developed. Mm. What does it look like as a child down there?
Well, like I say, it was terribly quiet and there were a lot of lanes. So we children spent a lot of time going down Farmfield Lane to... You should have picked a different day, I think.
I might just... Let me just turn that up a little bit. It's a very good mic on here, actually. So.
Is it?
Yeah.
But will it pick the drilling up as well?
It will pick that one up, but...
I'll talk a little bit louder.
It can't be avoided.
No. The power station, yes. You see, all these little lanes were there, and we knew people who lived at the bottom of the lanes, right? We were all friends. And the mothers, you see, were all very friendly because there was nobody else. And so you brought your children up together and you walked into each other's houses without, you know, by your leave, really. Everybody was auntie. There was auntie one, and, you know, all around the village, everybody were aunties. Anyway, they weren't connected, but that's what we did. So we were allowed to roam freely as children, and you've always met up with, somebody else, maybe Cynthia or Elizabeth or Daphne or somebody down the road. And I can remember very much as a child, I couldn't have been more than three, and we had a small garden gate going out into the lane. We had the most beautiful little cottage garden in the front with privet hedges and beautiful musk roses, all the old-fashioned plants, lilacs and growing up, and we had a huge vegetable garden there. Anyway, I can remember everybody that came walked in through this little gate at the bottom of the path. And one day I can remember Mr. Harrison, our policeman, used to have a bike and would go around the village. And my mother must have been in the garden, and he stopped to speak. You always stopped to talk to people in those days. So there was nothing much else going on. And I remember him so well saying to my mother, "Well, Mrs. Collingbourne, this'll be the end of the village as we know it. When this power station's built, nothing will ever be the same here again." And I remember this so clearly. And so he was right. Because then, with the building of it, of course, everything had to come through the village. Now, it wasn't safe for children to roam anymore. So it curtailed our movements somewhat.
So it would be, the late 40s?
They started building about 49, I believe. And then... I can remember being a young child. It probably took a while to build, but in the early 50s, Ryan's of Mountain Ash had an Aberdeer, had perhaps one lorry every minute or 5 minutes going down that road past us.
Wow.
full of black coal, like ash type. Yeah. And if they swung round our bend so quickly, you'd end up with a lot of this stuff all over the road. Now, if you'd been a child walking there, it really wasn't safe.
Mm. And what was there before the power station? What?
I've drawn all the houses they knocked down.
Oh.
It was a wharf.
A wharf?
Yes, a wharf. Boats used to come in there.
Wow.
And tie up. I've probably been the only one that's been incensed by the amount of destruction that's taken place in a small area over the last 60, 70 years. And there were little old farmhouses. It was all farmed. And there were the Williamses and the Bassetts and various other families who lived in these houses, the Hales, and places like Cold Harbour Farm, Little Farm, Red Barn Farm. All these houses were there, with quite large families living in them. But of course they all had to go, and they were all erased.
It was compulsory purchase?
Oh, yes.
So where did they go, these people?
Well, that's a good question. The Williamses stayed in the parish. They had another house. Yes.
It must have been devastating.
I was just thinking of the places where they moved to. It's a bit complicated for people to understand, really, without actually seeing it. So I drew the map, and I've put all the houses on there. And I've actually sketched all the houses.
Oh.
So that at some time in the future, somebody will know what I've been talking about. And I knew the people who lived there. And I've written about the people who lived there. And you see, it was so close to the docks in Newport, it was just across the river. So that when anything happened down there, people would just flock down to the wharf to have a look what was going on. Like when Lord Tredegar, his new yacht was launched, so everybody from Nash goes down to have a look.
Really?
Oh, yes. Hubert Jones, he wrote about that, and I've got it in my book. And I've talked about it to people. I've read them my whatever I've written. And people are fascinated because the school outings, the Sunday school outings, they'd take their picnics down the wharf. Originally, there were powder houses, and I've drawn those.
What's a powder house?
Oh, well, during the Napoleonic Wars in the late 70s, 1700s rather, the ammunition was, and the powder, gunpowder, were all stored in these powder houses on the wharf. And I suppose it was collected from the wharf when it was needed.
Gosh.
And there was a little place called the Windbound Tavern right next to the powder houses. And that you could go there to get drink.
Really?
Yes. And there's a little place called Thieves Pill, there's St. Julian's Pill. And all these places have reasons why they're called that.
Yeah. And it all gone?
Oh, yes, there's nothing, absolutely nothing left. Even where the sailing club is, everything has been demolished. And then after the power station came, you wouldn't know what it looked like, but I've got pictures of the power station as it was. And it was a double chimney power station. And then they built another one alongside it with a one chimney. Then they built a thermalite block works, and everything got built. Monsanto's came, everything was built, and then they knocked a few more farmhouses down and took all that away. Then Troston, Nash Road is where I remember going to David's family's farmhouses, all on in that area, where the new distributor road is. Mrs. Hogg had she lived in Spitty Farm there. And then there was Upper Lakes Farm. They knocked that down to put Aldi's. Then they knocked Bringwyn Farm down to put Nash Liswery School. So all that area was farmed quite, and up to Tesco's, Bringwyn Farm, which was David's cousin's place. I remember farming there with my friend Elizabeth, who's now my cousin, Waters, and they farmed Bringwyn Farm, and it went right up where Tesco's is.
As far as there?
Oh, yes, right up to the railway line, people farmed.
That's so incredible.
In my lifetime, which isn't that long ago, from the, you know, in terms of time.
Yeah.
Yes, I remember making hay with them and collecting the cattle and bringing them in. And so it would have been the 1960s. Because then, you see, the steelworks came. And that took this end of the village out. Totally.
Was it a similar scene with all the shale lorries coming up and down?
Oh, yes, yes. They even had to widen the road to bring them in. There was no other way to bring them in than through the Broad Street Common. You see?
Yes.
There was no other entry into the steelworks site. So
no other entry. See, that's just kind of hard to imagine.
But until they got it up and built, there wasn't, you see. So all these hundreds of shale lorries came down the common, and David tells me that they put hard stone standing each side of the road and made it wide enough for these lorries to come along.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, these changes within your lifetime. It's not that long, is it?
Well, I was 74 last week.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you. And yes, my memories go back to when I was 2 and 3. At 3 years of age, I remember walking to Sunday school. And I've never stopped going to church since.
So where's your church then, Sue?
Nash.
Still Nash?
Yes.
So was it very much part of your upbringing, going to church?
Oh, everything. Everything revolved around the church and the school. We didn't have a village hall in those days. So the school sort of lent itself for everything that was done in the village. Our harvest suppers and parties, everything was held in the schoolroom. Because we could make it go from 3 classrooms to 1 big room by putting partitions back and drawing curtains.
And so that was very much a part of community life?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, we had church 3 times on a Sunday. 9:30 communion, 3 o'clock Sunday school, and 6 o'clock evensong. Same people used to go, except us children would go to Sunday school as well.
So what would the congregation have looked like?
I would think we'd have been 30 to 40, easily.
Mm.
And we had a choir of probably 15 to 20 children. Mm.
So do you remember the vicar, was it the Reverend?
Oh, yes, Reverend Rhys Thomas. Oh, I could tell stories about him. Yes, he was there from 19, I believe it was during the war, First World War now, up until 1948 when he died. We had no vicarage in the village, but he had a house on Chepstow Road. And they had a car, so they would come. When he first came, there was horses. And they used to call him the sporting parson. I think they were from Crickhowell. Mrs. Rhys Thomas certainly was. And to envisage Mrs. Rhys Thomas, you could look at the Queen Mother,
yeah,
and you would imagine she would be exactly the same.
Mm.
She used to dress with wonderful furs, the most amazing hats, and she had a terribly cultivated voice. And she was the dearest, kindest lady you could imagine. And she went around the village taking cakes and sitting with people when they were ill and really put her heart and soul into village life.
Oh.
Now, I don't remember Vicar Rhys Thomas at all. I think he died before I had memories. He must have been there, because I can remember at 3 walking over to Good Friday service at 11 o'clock and my brother holding my hand and taking me. And we had, as a treat, chocolate finger biscuits. And this took place on a Good Friday. Now, Val Bassett, who used to live in the village, an old family from Nash, she said when she was a young girl, and she must have been 20 years older than me, she said they had hot cross buns on Good Friday, which would have been in the, you know, 30s. So they were like benefactors, Mr. and Mrs. Rees-Thomas. And the only story I can remember my parents telling me was, my father didn't go to church because there was always milking to do when we were children. And my mother had four children and worked on the farm as well. So she didn't often came, but she made sure that we were well versed in Bible stories and expected to go. Anyway, they used to like to go to tea at various places. And it was the custom that you invited them. And I remember he had obviously been to Red House, and my parents had, you know, you always made an effort if you had guests for tea though, in those days, because food was quite scarce, you see, during the war years. Mm. And he must have gone to church the following week, and when he was in the pulpit, he was saying about the scarcity of food, and he said, "Mind you, there are people in the village who live like little Hitlers." And, of course, people knew exactly where they'd been to tea. But, of course, farmers weren't short of food. And we also had a butcher's shop, which was supplying all of Newport with meat. So we didn't have a shortage of food.
Where was the butcher's shop?
Oh, in Griffin Street in Newport. Mm. So, yes, we have... They were known as farmer butchers because we had our own farm. My grandfather, after he left the Tredegar estate, bought his own farm, and they rear their own animals for slaughter. But yeah, so that was one thing. But I knew there were lots of other tales in the village about our reverend. But and his wife remained faithful up till when she died. In 1972, she died. So she still visited. She was godmother to nearly every child that was born in the village because, you know, people couldn't travel in the 1930s and 40s. So she had a wonderful way with children, and we never forgot them. And in latter years, before she died, she put the east window in stained glass in memory of her husband.
Oh, gosh.
So that was a very nice tribute for
him.
Are
there any images of him anywhere?
No. I have got a photograph of him at the reopening of the extension of Nash School in 1924.
Oh, gosh.
And that's the only picture I have of him. That's in my file. So, yes.
Wasn't there a story about Nash Church Tower during the war? Was it where the bodies were brought from sea? Am I imagining that?
No, it was always used as a mortuary because there were often people being washed up on the seashore. And people were drowned in reeds. Now, if they weren't known to the families, they were brought up and laid on the tower floor. Old Mr. Cox. Mr. Cornelius Cox, who lived in Church Farm adjacent, he was church warden for most of his life. He taught us to ring bells. He and his wife kept our church doors open. They lit the fires. They lit the oil lamps. I remember them doing both.
There was a fire in the church?
Oh, yes. Where the church porch is now, there was a fire grate where the doors are.
Really?
And as a child, when I was growing up, to the age of probably 12, we always had a fire in the grate. Well, there was no other heating in the winter, long before electric came to the village. And yes, we had a pot-bellied stove, which they took several pews out to put. It was in the centre of the Isle at one time, in the 30s and 40s, and then they moved it, took two pews out and in front of the bell tower and put it there. You see the holes in the roof now.
And you did bell ringing as a child?
Yes, when I was, I think I was 11 when I started, and we had a team. There was nothing else in the village to do, so you learned how to bell ring, because we were a crowd of youngsters who got together on a Wednesday evening, and then we rang Sunday morning and Sunday evening.
So, just going back to Nash Wharf, forgive me, Sue, for jumping around, but I don't want to forget, but...
No.
So was Nash Wharf, was it known for smuggling in its time?
Oh, yes, the whole of the estuary, from where it goes into the River Usk, right down probably to Chepstow, the stories, we don't know how much is true, but, of course, they'd wave the lights and bring the boats onto the rocks or the mud or whatever, and then they would loot the brandy, and it was I'm not saying constabulary, whatever it was before constabulary, would often search farm outbuildings and come across brandy and what whiskey and whatever. Contraband.
Yeah.
Yes, and they say a lot of people made their money from that down here. But, we just don't know how true it is.
So where the wharf was, that was where, it was a bit of a viewpoint, was it? A lookout point?
Yes, yes, you could say that. It was like a bulge. I'll show you the map later, and you can see for yourself.
Because I went down there some months back to try to get to the sailing club, but I couldn't get there because of the power station.
You have to have a number or somebody has to tell you. You've got to key it in.
Ah, right. Yeah.
And there was an open day there a week last Saturday.
Oh, gosh, really?
And had I been well enough, I would have gone down.
Oh, crikey.
Because we've got a cousin who has a boat there, and he'd take us down any time, I guess. And that was right against, I think it's against Thieves' Pill.
So, as a child, did you play in and around the reams at all? Were you warned away by your parents?
I think if you grow up with them, you're always aware of them. I think if we had visitors or other children come to play, you'd always tell them, don't go near the reams. I think you were usually up until five or six, and then you could be trusted to play outside. But you always had somebody with you. Yes, because we lived opposite Windmill Reen, which was quite a wide water course there. But we had lots of small ditches going through the farm. But they didn't have such high banks in those days. And you could sit on the bank and put your toes in. Whereas all around our farm, the reens have been cast so many times, the banks are too high to do that, unless we've dug waterings.
But has it been a source of, you mentioned drownings before, has there been much of that over
there? Yes, yes.
Yeah.
In the church registers, every year you'd see somebody had drowned, a child or an adult. And they were never quite sure if the adults had drowned on purpose or whether they'd fallen in accidentally and couldn't get out. Which, you see, there doesn't seem to be a bottom to some of these reens. You know, if you get your feet in the muck, ooh, it almost drag you under.
Oh, gosh.
So it, you know, it's...
Did you ever swim in them as a child or jump over them?
No, we used to swim in the mud down the seawall. Because there wasn't a wall in those days. It was just a bit of a ditch or a bank that we used to picnic in. And Auntie Dorothy lived at, and Uncle Donald, they lived at Farm Field. They were David's family, but they were our friends as children. And our summers were spent going, my mother taking us children down to her, with her children, walking down to the seawall, having picnics. And we only had rugs to lay out. And us children would go off with towel and bathing costumes, and you'd get stuck in this mud. If the water came in, you'd be okay, and then we'd come out covered in mud. But the parents didn't seem to stop us.
That was just a summer's... That was like going to the beach.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. And as I got older, my other cousin, Elizabeth, from Great House, which is just before the wetlands, and they took all their lands for the wetlands. Well, when we were children, we'd walk down there to just where the power station was pushing out the water. They had this huge, huge drain with warm water coming out of it. And we used to go down in our bathing costumes and go out in the water in the sea. I think we were about 12. And then come up and sit under this warm water. Goodness knows what was in it. But our parents didn't tell us not to. So Elizabeth and I used to do that and then walk back up the fields to the house. And of course it was all their land.
Wow.
So amazing. And you see, when the power station came initially, they hadn't taken a huge tract of land. So we had access right up to the fence around it. And then, of course, they needed to buy all, compulsory purchase, all the land around it for ash ponds. So then, of course, it became out of bounds. You had these huge high fences and it was like quicksand. And this would be probably eight feet above ground level. And they'd fill them with this whatever came out of the power station, just ash. And that is why when you come out of the wetlands, you go up this huge slope, because that was where the ash ponds were.
Really?
Yes. And it was probably hundreds of acres. And eventually they bought up farm field. They even demolished that to put the ash ponds.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, it breaks my heart when I look back and see how they just bulldozed our village out of memory.
Yeah, so were they old buildings?
Oh, yes, farm field had been there hundreds of years.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was a beautiful house, absolutely beautiful. And that was our playground anyway.
You said there was no sea wall, Sue.
No.
Forgive me for sounding a bit silly and stupid, but what kept the sea out at high tide then if there was no sea wall?
Well, it just used to rush into this big ditch and fill that up and then go back out.
Oh, really?
And then it would leave water in the bottom of the ditch. But I'm talking about the summers when it was very dry.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But there was a wall of stones in parts. And then they started making a proper wall, probably in the 50s.
Mm.
And of course, when the steelworks came, we had a huge wall built. They were taking lorry loads of these monster pieces of rock to make this wall.
Oh, really?
And it's evident to me that when you're down the seawall and you go to the lighthouse, you're looking down into the lighthouse thing. When we were children, we were 6 feet below the lighthouse, looking up at it.
Oh, really?
So that's the extent of the ash ponds, and the wall was built so the steelworks didn't get flooded.
I've never heard that before.
Oh, yes.
That gives it real tangibility.
Mm-hmm. And there were lots of places in Goldcliffe where you only had a mud wall. You see, that's what the Romans put there originally, was a mud wall. And then as centuries went by, it all fell into disrepair. And then I guess the monks decided they'd pile in and put more mud there. And it was up to the farmers to maintain it. And if they didn't, they were fined by the Court of Sewers.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So if your farm happened to have land where the seawall was,
yes,
that was your responsibility?
Oh, yes, yes.
So when did that change?
Well, that's debatable, because some people say it never changed. But I think more so when this last century, in the 1900s, I think things changed at the beginning of that time.
Mm. But when you were a child, did you ever experience a high tide?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, it was lovely.
what?
You'd run down to see the water over the fields.
Would you?
Yeah. But, no, the last time, apparently, the water actually filled the village was 1937. And a cousin, Margaret Dredge, she told me, or she was Margaret Waters, she told me, in my lifetime, she was a district nurse. Mm. And she told me that they had boats going up and down the road from Nash Arch to the Bower Station. And that was 1937.
Wow.
And David's father was farming here, and the water had come over in Goldcliffe as well. So, yes, and going back before then, it came over regularly because I've got the school register for Goldcliffe School back the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, and you'll see where the teacher has marked so-and-so Keith, not in school today, the tide floods in the village. And then you'd see that every 2 or 3 years.
Gosh.
Children couldn't get to school because their lanes were flooded.
Yeah, goodness.
So it wasn't unusual. Do you want some coffee? Should we break for coffee?
Should we break for coffee? Yeah, that would be lovely. Let me just finish this off soon.
Goodness, this is fantastically fascinating stuff.
Is it?